Welcome to the Everesting Podcast. This is a special episode. I am welcoming Marcus Leach on, who is an ultra-endurance cyclist from the UK. He's a world traveler, adventurer, a very, very inspirational human being. I had the honor of meeting Marcus a few years ago now on the Adventure Audio Podcast, where I had the opportunity to host him. He has since completed additional Everestings. He's a five-time Everester, including some gravel Everesting, which he's going to tell us about. So, Marcus, thank you so much for your time. Everybody, you're in for a treat. He is just one of my favorite follows on Instagram as well. It's Marcus Leach Global is how you can follow he and his family on their adventures. He is a person who is packing a lot of living into his life and love following along with people like that. So, Marcus, thank you again. And I hope this has sent you on a journey, perhaps, to complete another Everesting, and we can chat again soon. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by the State Bicycle Company. You can visit State at statebicycle.com. You can use code AUDIO100, so AUDIO100, and that will give you $100 off of a bicycle. So they have bikes starting at $399. They also have an e-bike available now too. Definitely worth checking them out. And they always have seasonal deals and parts and apparel. So you can give them a follow on the socials at State Bicycle on Instagram or Facebook or wherever else you like to spend your time on social media. But that's a great way to stay up with what they're doing. And on to this episode of the podcast with Marcus Leach.
So, hey, we're here to talk about Everesting today.
We are.
I wanted to reach out because when we first met, I hosted you on my other podcast called Adventure Audio back in December of 2020. So that was when we were blissfully ignorant. We'd probably just heard of coronavirus is what we called it back then. And there was little pockets of it happening in the world. But I ignorantly still believed that it was, it was going to be like SARS or something that never kind of really, really ultimately affected my world. And it sure did. It affected everybody's world. But that it reminded me when I looked that up that you're actually like an early adopter of Everesting, because the pandemic actually accelerated it and put it on a rocket and created it in, it made it much more of a global phenomenon because a whole bunch of pros and really experienced racers and stuff like that were taking it on because it was a DIY project and they could sort of control their environment, do it close to home, not have to travel. But you were actually Everesting back in 2019 when it was a little more, a lot less mainstream, I guess I'll put it that way. I'd certainly heard of it by then, but had yet to take it on. But I think you had done two at that point when I spoke with you.
Yeah. So as you said, I remember Everesting being like sort of more niche and sort of like an underground thing back then.
Totally.
You're right. It was massively accelerated during the pandemic because it was something that you could do indoors at home locally. It was, something for people to do. But yeah, for me, when I discovered Everesting, there wasn't the wealth of knowledge, information, I wouldn't say hype around it because it's not hype, but, media coverage of it. I just did it as something, I wouldn't say just something to do, because I don't think you just do an Everesting because you're bored or anything. But it was, it was very much an early days thing. So I went into my first one quite naively, if I'm being honest. I hadn't researched segments or pacing strategies or fueling strategies. It was a case of finding a hill that I knew that was 2 miles from my house, because then it would be easy to drop some supplies off in the hedge. I didn't have a support crew, and I just went and did it, and it was an ordeal.
That is absolutely the right word to describe it. It definitely is an ordeal. Tell me about that first one. So you went out like by yourself with some kit, food, some supplies, and you started grinding it out. And that was a road Everesting, the first one?
Yes. Yeah. So just very quickly, just to say, I've now done 4 Everestings, 2 roads, 2 gravel, and then I've done a virtual base camp and a virtual 10K as well. But that very first one, as I said, I was quite naive at the time. I'd done an ultra race in the early part of 2019. I think it was January I did my very first ultra race, which was a 1,200 kilometer race in Oman, and I didn't have another event planned until May time. And I was kind of like a little bit bored with my training. I wanted something to focus myself on where I wasn't just going out doing intervals, doing zones. And I've always been this kind of person who likes to look for extreme challenges. I'd say it's one of my strengths and one of my weaknesses. I'm all or nothing. If I buy into a project or buy into doing something, it has to be at the extreme end. So I remember just sort of thinking it would be cool to go and do a load of vertical gain because I like going uphill. And I started Googling, and that's when I found this Everesting idea, and I was like, okay, cool, I'll do one. I knew the basic concept, I read the basic rules. You cycle up and down a mountain until you've clocked, you know, the height of Everest. No sleep, and just get on with it. So I just found a hill that was close to home. I didn't really look at gradients. I just thought, what's the biggest climb that's near?
I'm laughing because people really obsess about these details, and you just did the opposite. You're like, it's close, it's steep, off I go.
Yeah, and it was kind of like less than two, from starting to research it to doing it, it was a less than a 2 week window. We had the Easter holidays coming up. I knew that I had a window of opportunity where my wife had friends visiting, so that, you know, if I disappeared for a day, it really wouldn't matter, especially with the kids and things. And I just set off and did it. I loaded up a hiking rucksack with food and water and some spare parts. I got up at midnight. I cycled to the bottom of the climb and walked up about 100 meters and stashed the bag in the hedge. I walked back down, got on my bike and started, knowing that I had to do 51 laps of this climb. And it was only about 10 laps in that I suddenly realized that maybe I should have researched a little bit more, because it was pretty steep in places. And I'm a big guy. I think it was about 93 kilos at the time. So it registered as a short Everesting or a steep Everesting, the badge was. I didn't know that at the time. I just, you know, just did it. It ended up being 180 kilometers, I think it was. So
yeah, that is short. That's, so you must have been like 11-12% average gradient. That's steep. Really, yeah. Steep.
And there's a couple of pitches in the middle where it was sort of like high teens as well. So
and you did, and no specialized gearing. This is a quote-unquote regular road bike.
Just my standard road bike. Yeah, just my standard bike with no real strategy, no pacing. I've never been one, even though I use a power meter, I've never been one, unless I'm doing intervals, to ride to power. I've always just ridden to how I feel. And if I feel like I can push on a little bit, I push on. And if I don't, I ease off. So I never really sort of factored in thinking, you know, I need to stick to this power curve for this long. So it did progressively get harder for me because, as I said, I'm all or nothing. So I kind of pushed reasonably hard. And I think the challenge I had was I quickly realized after about 10 reps that I didn't have enough time to recover in between climbs. So by the time I was getting back to the bottom, even though I thought I was feeling sort of good again, it was only, I don't know, 6 or 7 minute descent maximum. Maybe even a bit shorter, and then I was going again. So it didn't really give me enough time to recover.
I think a steeper hill obviously creates some advantage because you're shortening the overall time that you need to spend out there by limiting the kilometers. However, I think the steeper the hill, the less recovery you get. You're much more engaged on that descent. It's more of, you know, there's more upper body, like there's more going on, and you can't really switch off.
Yeah, and I also think there is that sort of sweet spot, because having now done several Everestings and done some longer ones, and I've gone the other way where the climb's been too long, where, you know, you're descending for too long, then you're getting cold, you're mentally switching off. So I definitely think there is a sweet spot, but I think it needs to be a little bit longer than the climb that I did for my first one. And I got through it though. I mean, if I look, I looked at the stats just out of interest earlier. My ride time for the Everesting was 14 hours.
That's a fast Everesting.
And I had 2 hours rest in that. So, and then it's really interesting because if I look at my other Everestings, my next Everesting, which was another road one, was 14 hours. First one was 14 hours, 2 minutes ride time. And a year later, I did one 14 hours, 3 minutes ride time, both with 2 hours rest. And it was like, there was no planning to sort of try and pace it to that. It just worked out that that was what it was.
That's pretty remarkable. Was the second one a similar gradient?
No, the second one, it's a funny story. When I did the first one, I said to my wife, I'm never doing that again. That was ridiculous. Please never let me do that again. And about a year later, Cyclist magazine in the UK came to me, and I write for them as a freelancer. And they came to me and said, by this stage, it had started to take off. There was a lot more media coverage around it. And obviously magazines wanted to cover Everesting, but there was not a glut of journalists putting their hands up to say, hey, I'll go and do an Everesting for you.
Right. So they'd rather find somebody that had maybe already done that, right?
Yeah. So Cyclist came to me, and I had a bit of a reputation with them that if there was something ridiculously hard, I would take the project. And they said to me, will you do one? And I said, yeah, that's no problem. When do you need me to do it by? They were like, well, we need the article for in 2 weeks' time. So again, I had very little sort of warning that I'd be doing an Everesting. But by this time, I'd read a lot more about picking the right hill, fueling, loads of different elements that people obsess about before they go and do it. But I also had to factor in, I needed to find a hill that was scenic because it was going to be for a magazine. So at least needed not just to be like a dead end climb in an industrial estate or somewhere right. like this. So I'd actually picked a really beautiful hill in South Wales that was about 2.5 kilometers long. It had beautiful views. It had everything we sort of really needed. I drove up there the night that we were going to start. I met my friend who's the photographer, and we drove up to the top of the climb where the car park was, where I was going to leave the motorhome, which has always been my sort of base camp for Everesting, because it's perfect. You don't need a support crew. You can park it at a climb. You can put everything you need in there, from food, drink, spare clothing, the full works. If it gets nasty weather, you've got like a safe haven. So we got to the top of the climb, and the wind was horrendous, absolutely horrendous. And we just realized it wasn't going to be safe to even try and start Everesting on this climb. And in normal circumstances, you'd say, no problem, we'll come back tomorrow, come back in a few days. But I was like, well, I need to do this article. I've been commissioned. So at the very last minute, I found, or I knew of another climb that I could use, but it would require me to do 100 repetitions. Which wasn't really what I wanted to do, because mentally I think the thought of having to do something 100 times is pretty grueling. So we quickly transferred an hour across sort of Wales to this other climb, and that second climb I did was 100 repetitions of a climb that was just over a kilometer long.
That must have been stressful, though, because you're already moving into, like, you're kind of getting ready to go. And then you feel the clock burning, too, because, you know, you can't go back to sleep. So you're already thinking about, I've already been awake for this long and I haven't even started yet. Right.
Yeah. And then you start worrying, because my idea when you Everesting, and I know everyone has a different tactic, but for me, I would rather start super early in the morning in the dark and finish in daylight. Because unless you're riding sort of like, you know, like crazy times and you can start and finish in the daylight, most people at some stage are going to have to do battle with darkness. And
definitely at least once, some people twice.
Yeah. least once. And I think personally for me, it's easier to deal with riding in the dark when you're fresh, when, you know, if you've gone to bed early the day before and you've had some rest. Mentally, it's easier for me to do that. And it sounds silly, but actually, you can almost sort of clock off a whole chunk of Everesting before it gets daylight and you really feel like you're riding. Because I feel when you're riding in the dark, you can't see the hill in front of you. So mentally, it's not as difficult. Whereas if you're looking up a road and you can see the climb, that can be a mental challenge sometimes. And in the dark, even though the climb is the same, you don't have that visual reminder of what's ahead of you every time you're turning around and looking back up.
Right, right. Good tip. Was this one a gravel Everesting?
No, this one was another road Everesting. Okay. And again, like I said, I was 1 minute longer of my ride time than the first one, which was kind of spooky when I just looked at the data now. And again, 2 hours rest time in total.
Well, especially because the gradient was not the same. That's what makes it particularly amazing. So you were riding faster, but you're riding farther. Like, how many kilometers did that one take? You did 180, and then what was the second one?
So this second one I'm looking at here in total was 206 kilometers.
Okay, so that's also quite short. I know it didn't quite tick under the Andes short parameter, which is the 200 kilometer limit, but that's also a very steep hill because there's lots of entries in that are 250 to 350 total, right?
Yeah, and this one was a straight up hill. There was no corners, nothing. It was just over 1 kilometer. It's a dead straight road, apart from a tiny little kink at the top. So again, I struggled with recovery in terms of, you know, a dead straight road, there's no braking until the bottom. You're back down the climb in seconds for a kilometer. I mean, it was just over a minute sometimes coming back down. So,
And then you get back down, hard on the brakes, turn, go, right?
Yeah. And again, it was a steep hill. So for a bigger guy, it wasn't optimal.
Well, and I think about, like, a lot of it to me is odds and statistics. So if you do 100 reps, you've got actually 200 turns. So you have 200 opportunities to screw up and fall. Or, you know, as we get fatigued, like I've heard lots of these stories. I was at 6,000 meters and I just was doing my regular routine turn and down I went, right?
Yeah, I mean, I've, you know, touch wood, I've always been fortunate in that sense that I never had any mishaps in terms of crashes or that sort of fatigue from that side. So I was very fortunate on that front, even though it can easily happen, especially when you get mentally fatigued. I've been there on other rides where you've been riding for a long time and just something innocuous happens and the next thing you're falling off. And if you've been riding for 10 hours, it amplifies everything.
Yeah, exactly. So now you have done short, you've done soil and you've done suburban. So was one of those ones suburban? Okay, so the straight 1 kilometer hill was a suburban climb. Okay, so that leaves you a significant, I mean, and then you've got the 4S badge too. So is there some planning perhaps for another one?
Well, funnily enough, I've had, every time I've done an Everesting, I'm like, I'm never doing that again. And then something happens and you think, oh, I'll just do one more. And before you know it, you've done five of them. And, you know, you're like a serious offender. I never really did Everesting to set out to get these badges or anything. But obviously, like you say, there's that 1S left. And we were in Greece earlier this year, and my little boy is, he's 8 now, and he's super into Greek mythology. So as we were driving around Greece, we were going to all of these places, and obviously Mount Olympus is where the Greek gods live. And he wanted to drive the motorhome up to the top of Mount Olympus so that we could wild camp at the top and spend a couple of days there. And it honestly is the most beautiful road. It's a dead end climb and it's about 15 kilometers. And I know Phil Guymon has done an Everesting on one of the sections, which is like the steepest part of it. It's like a 2 kilometer section where it's 10 to 15%. And if I was going to do a significant, I think I would go back to Greece and do it there. And I have an opportunity to potentially do it, so we will see. There's a lot of other projects and other things happening in the next 12 months, but I'd be lying if I said I haven't been thinking about it and potentially planning it a little bit.
Okay, I went in looking at that, I just thought there's no way it's not on his mind, so I had to ask about that. So when Tell me about the one on soil. What was that like? That is a different ball game completely.
Yes, Everestings 3 and 4 were both soil gravel ones, and they're like, you can't, I don't think you can even compare the two. They're like two completely different experiences, and they were significantly harder. My time, ride time for the first soil one was 15 hours and 35 minutes, so an extra hour and a half. And it's funny because when I did the first Everesting, I did that in 2019. When I did the first Everesting, it was 2019, and I said I'll never do that again. And then a year later, I ended up doing 3 in 4 months.
That's a lot.
Yeah, and in between Everesting 2 and 3, I did a 2,600-kilometer ride the length of the UK in 14 days with 50,000 meters of climbing. So
is that the is that Land's End to John O'Groats? Is that their ride?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, but the normal route for that is only about, I say only, it's about only 1,500 kilometers.
That's
if you take a more direct route. But I basically got offered the opportunity to do it as a project for the magazine, where they wanted me to take the most scenic route that took in every single climb that I could find on the way. So it ended up being significantly longer with every day. I think I averaged something like 3,500 meters climbing a day for 14 days. Ooh. It was brutal.
That is gigantic.
So I did that in between the two Everestings. So I finished that, and 3 weeks later, I did the gravel Everesting. And again, it was fairly steep. I did it, it was just looking at the stats, it was 212 kilometers, the total ride, for just shy of 9,000 meters.
And you were riding a regular gravel bike for that, or a mountain bike?
No, I had just a standard gravel bike for that. I didn't change anything. I only had one bottle cage on. I think that's the only thing that I did different. I was like, I only need one bottle. I had a resupply at the top. Again, it was in the woods close to home. It was on a climb that I really loved, and I'd ridden a few times with my mum on her e-mountain bike, and she was the one who actually said to me, this would make a good Everesting route. So you know you're doing well when your mum's telling you where, like, you should be Everesting.
Definitely. That's great. But that's awesome.
But then I think my support crew when I've done my Everestings has always been my family. At some stage, my mum and dad would turn up, my wife would come with the kids. And that was kind of my motivation to keep going, just having a little break, switching off for half an hour, sitting with them and pretending that I wasn't doing this ordeal. And for half an hour, it just gave me that mental space to decompress and then refocus again to sort of to finish the last bit of the challenge. But I think from a gravel Everesting point of view, the real difficulty for me is how focused you have to be on the descent. Because even if you're on a really good gravel surface, the risk of crashing or losing your traction or coming off is so much higher from the smallest mishap or sort of lapse in concentration. So I found myself, the mental fatigue hit me so much earlier in the ride.
Because you just felt you had to be so much more acutely focused all of the time.
Yeah, because I've ridden a lot of gravel since. I haven't done a huge amount then, but I've ridden a lot since. And even on like the most gnarly of gravel climbs, going up, apart from having to look out for the odd sort of root or rock that you might have to avoid, it's not too mentally taxing. I find that I can switch off a little bit and just tap out a rhythm on a climb and it's good. But the moment you're coming downhill, you know, every meter there's like 3 or 4 things that could potentially cause you to crash. And so I think the reason it took me longer was just the mental fatigue of having to focus that much. And especially, again, starting in the dark, descending a gravel track in the dark with a bike light is stressful.
Yeah, did you, that's what I was going to ask about the night riding. So did you have like a really high-powered, high-lumen light to do that with?
Yeah. I had a really, really strong light. It was like a car headlight, basically. That sort of power. So I could see everything. But it's really funny because when I ride gravel and climb on gravel, like, you know, there's no risk of cars and things. So you can chuck your headphones in and listen to music, listen to podcasts. But I couldn't do that riding in the dark because it sounds really stupid. But riding in the woods at 3 o'clock in the morning on your own is quite scary. Like,
totally. I've done night riding. It's exhilarating, but it is definitely scary.
You can't hear things.
Yeah, absolutely. Everything you hear,
yeah,
you don't know.
Stupid scenarios in my head. If I had my headphones in, that I'd look around and suddenly someone would be stood next to me.
Was this a rural area? Like, was wildlife a concern?
Thankfully, yeah, it was completely in the woods. I mean, the worst we would have is maybe a small wild boar or a small deer or something in the night. So probably not the same sort of animals that some people have to contend with in parts of the world. So I didn't really worry about hitting anything. But no, it was spooky. I was quite glad when the sun came up.
I bet. Yeah. And there's a real psychological boost to the sun coming up, right? It's the start of the day. So even if you've got a chunk of mileage or elevation behind you, it does feel like a new fresh beginning, right?
It's amazing. And the morale boost that gives you. And that's why I say I like to start in the dark rather than go into the dark. Because I think the opposite happens if you're riding and it starts to get dark, because I think it can remind you now that, you know, you're into the night and it's bleak and it can be really mentally tough. Whereas for me, even when I'm not riding a bike, my favorite part of the day is being out for a walk or something where you're in the dark and you get to see that first sliver of light on the horizon. You know, it's the promise of a new day. There's endless opportunity. And it's just this magical moment. And the rest of the world's normally asleep at that stage. Out there.
There's these great debates.
Up, maybe two or three.
Yeah, there's these great debates, and you've probably seen them in the Facebook group for Everesting of like, when do I start? When do I start? Right. And I think I always say that I think it depends largely on how many hours you think you're going to be total, and then try and work it backwards from there. And exactly like you said, don't finishing at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, a few hours before the sun's going to come up, that does you absolutely no good. You try and actually reverse engineer it from that and get that boost of the sun coming up when you need it the most, because we can't fool our body clocks. And if you keep a regular-ish schedule and you're not working shift work and you're not used to being up all night, I think that that's a huge win.
Yeah, and I completely agree with you. And because my last or the fourth of the sort of the outdoor Everestings was on gravel again, and I misjudged it all. I did it again for a magazine project. And again, I picked the climb that I thought would be best for the magazine, some beautiful scenic photography. I bought in a few other brands as well, to sort of maximize the commercial element of doing a fourth Everesting. I thought if I'm going to do it, I may as well, you know, make a bit of money out of it as well. And I did both on that ride. I started in the dark and I had to finish in the dark. And the last two reps of a 10K climb in the dark were soul destroying. The speed I was climbing at, the mental games I had to play with myself to get through, it took all my mental resolve to finish in the dark when everything was telling me just stop.
Yeah, it does. It starts to pile up. And even though that's another piece of advice that I've given to people, is that you need to have some of your rebuttals ready to go. you need to know yourself well enough to know what type of excuses you're going to give yourself. Like, well, that's, it's an already a pretty big ride. Maybe I'll just call it a half Everest. Like, you're going to do these things to yourself, and you need to start to pre-prepare some of your own mental rebuttals to those complaints, I think.
And I think that's the biggest challenge about not just Everesting, but any big endurance challenge is, I think, if you've trained and you're a fit cyclist, you're a fit runner, whatever your sort of endurance event is, if you're fit physically, I think that's paid maybe 30% of taking on a big challenge. I think the rest of it is the mental strength. And I think mental strength is something that you build up incrementally over the years with everything you take on. Knowing how far you can push yourself, knowing how you react in certain situations, and Everesting takes you to that next level. And I think that's why it's good to sort of build up to it. And if you can do a base camp and get some experience, if I looked back now and did it again, maybe I would have sort of built up to it. But I guess I was fortunate that I'd come from an endurance background where it wasn't repetitions, but I was doing ultra racing where, you know, I was used to riding 16, 17 hour days. So I knew what my mental state's like in those situations. And therefore, I can control that inner voice, that inner demon, the little voice that the harder something gets, the louder that voice gets in your head that just says it would just be easier to stop. And I've listened to it in the past. I think it's human. And for about a minute, I've been grateful I've listened to it. And then afterwards, the regret and the like, why didn't you just continue? And all of the other voice of reason comes back through. So I know what it's like to be in those situations. So I think if you've got a bank of experience going into an Everesting, it makes it significantly easier. Not that it is easy, but it's easier to deal with the mental demons when they come. And mental demons, coming back to what we're saying about sunrise, sunset, everything's amplified in the dark. The ease to stop in the dark is greater. The loudness of the voice in your head telling you to stop is greater. And that's why I like to finish in the daylight and start in the dark when I'm super fresh, super motivated, and you know, you feel like I can conquer the world. And you haven't got to that 6,000 meter mark where all of a sudden you think, oh my God, there's a long way to go.
That's actually great advice, that everything's amplified in the dark. I haven't heard it articulated that way, but I think that you're right. And for some reason, 6,000 does seem to be the number where people start to think like, why am I even doing this? Right? Like, what for? Now you're doing it for a magazine article. It's your job. That's a different motivator for the average person who's just like, I could go home. I could go home right now. The RV thing scares me a little bit though, to have a bed nearby. That would be the only thing about the RV that would worry me, having it so close and accessible.
Well, the thing I do is I just don't make the bed. So I put stuff on the bed, like any boxes of nutrition stuff or kit or anything goes on the bed. So if I do go into the RV, all I can do is I can sit down, I can access the kitchen, the toilet and all of that stuff. So it takes away the temptation to sort of lie down and close your eyes for a little bit.
Make it as uncomfortable as possible. Even my car seat started to become incredibly inviting towards the end of my Everesting. Right? I was like, ooh, I could sit here for a little bit longer. So yeah, and you know what, you've done, you had a huge advantage going in by having done ultra stuff, right? Once you're over that 10 hour mark-ish, I think is 10, 12 hours once you've done beyond that. Because a lot of people are taking this challenge on really fit cyclists, but their long, long rides are 4 or 5 hours. And now they're going like, quadruple that sometimes, right? It's a massive change.
And you know, it's really interesting because I, like everyone, I got swept up in all of like watching people take on the record. And you know, I remember, I think the first person I was aware who sort of set the official record was Keegan Swinton. And then following that, it sort of like Lachlan Morton was doing it.
Then it dropped a bunch of times in short order. Yeah.
And then the Irish guy got it, and I think he still has it, and it just got ridiculous. It got to the point where
Ronan,
I was like,
yeah.
But yeah, Ronan. So, and the thing I was really interested in watching it is, as amazing as those times are, I think I have a greater level of admiration for the people who are doing it in like 24 hours plus, because they're out there for a hell of a long time. And I know the other guys are still pushing themselves to their absolute limit, but they're starting and finishing the daylight. They're obviously emptying the tank, but mentally they don't have to battle so much as the people who are taking 24 hours plus. And I take my hat off to those people that they've got the mental fortitude to keep on going and to be that stubborn, to persevere and get to the end.
Totally. That it reminds me of a quote. I think American marathoner, I think his name was Bill Waters, who won the Boston Marathon and the New York Marathon. And you know, back then, this is I think in the 70s, so they're probably winning marathons in 220, something like that, 215. And he, you know, he said that he's like, I can't believe the 4 or 5 hour finishers. I can't run for 4 or 5 hours. No, that's kind of a it sounds like a bit of a backhanded compliment, right? But it's true. It is a different thing.
Yeah, totally. And I think maybe, I don't say people underestimate what it will take, but as you said, you know, people go out and do a 4 or 5 hour ride and then all of a sudden you're on the bike for 20 hours. And also I don't think you can really underestimate the mental difficulty of constantly turning around, going back up and down the same climb. I think I don't think when people are planning Everesting, they really factor the mental aspect of that in. Because there's almost like an elation at getting to the top of a climb. We all know what it's like. You go out, I did it this morning. I went out on a 15K climb here and I knew, right, empty the tank, get to the top 15K, turn around and go home. And then you get to back to the bottom and you're like, right, I've got to turn around and do that all over again and again and again.
Yeah, it is. And it is way different than doing a 400 kilometer ride that's point to point or out and back, because you've got all these, like, it's different. You're on a journey. You're traveling somewhere, where with an Everesting, especially on a shorter Everesting in distance, it's like I'm moving all day, but I didn't go anywhere. I just saw this whole day pass, but I'm just in the same place. Like it's very weird.
It's almost like being on a treadmill at the gym. I used to look at people in the gym running on a treadmill going, how the hell can you do that? You've just run for an hour and you've just stood on the same spot. And Everesting's not too much different to that. And especially when
it's
then you throw in like the world of virtual Everesting. And but I, funnily enough, the virtual Everesting, the 10K virtual Everesting I did, I don't want this to sound sort of blasé, but I found relatively easy.
Really? It sounds so brutal.
No, should I say I found it comparatively easy compared to the outdoor Everestings, because I think if you get your setup right, and I was like everyone during the pandemic, I rode a bunch on an indoor bike on my Watt bike. I used Zwift, I used Trainer Road, I used different platforms, and you master your setup in terms of where you have your fans, what entertainment you've got going on, where your sort of nutrition and all your things are. So you've got this like perfect environment. And outside of that, all you've got to do is pedal and keep yourself entertained. You know, you don't have to think about too much else. And as long as you've got that dialed in, and the fact is that, I mean, I did mine on the Alpe de Zwift. You get 12 minutes off the bike as well.
Right.
You can go and change your clothes. You can have a shower. You can make a coffee. You can just, I found that bit alone made life so much easier.
Yeah. And you can't get hurt, right? There's no, like the stakes feel high when you're Everesting, because if you crash, you know, there's obviously a lot to that. Right. And that's always my biggest concern with these things, especially every year I get older, I become a little more concerned with my safety and everybody else's that I know. I don't know. It's part of the aging process, I guess, but I become more concerned.
I think being a parent, I turned 40 this year and I've got two little ones. They're 5 and 8 now. And I'm exactly the same. When I look at what I was like 20 years ago, and I wouldn't say I was reckless in life, but I did things without really thinking or second guessing myself. Whereas now as a parent and, you know, reaching a certain age in life, you're a lot more cautious and you're a lot more worrisome about certain things.
Totally. It makes me feel good to hear other people say that. It's not just my own head. But yeah, the virtual, I think that out the Zwift specifically, because there's no point where it goes back up, right? So you can literally just leave the bike and come back, and then your avatar is just waiting for you at the bottom when you get back, right? So, but that's wild.
I guess I guess the flip side to that, though, is you're at home, and it would be super easy if you're struggling mentally to say, do you know what? I'm at home. I'll just get off. Like, I can see why people then would prefer the outdoor one. So I definitely think a standard road, normal Everesting is a lot harder than an indoor 10K Everesting.
Fair. Fair. Well, you are always up to really, really cool stuff, not just Everesting. So you're traveling the world, and you are doing and have done some truly incredible, incredible accomplishments on the bike, and you're clearly not done. Where can people follow along and find your work, find your writing, and follow along on your awesome Instagram account that I've been pretty into for years now?
So the best place to follow the adventures for cycling, travel, just seeing the world as we see it is on Instagram, and it's Marcus Leach Global. And as I said, I write as a freelance writer for different publications every month across a host of different topics. I promote all of the work through there. And I guess with what we do, living life on the road with our kids and seeing the world is, I don't want to be one of these people who says, just look at me, this is where we are, look how amazing the world is. But also, it's a warts and all look at life, but also to give people the practical knowledge to say, oh, that's amazing, I'd love to go and ride my bike there, or to help people, you know, expand their own horizons. Because I think for me, Everesting was always this vehicle to push my limits in life. And I think we all can do so much more than we think we can. And it's only when you challenge yourself and push yourself out of your comfort zone that you start to tap into your true potential. And it's a different level for everyone. And through what we do as a family, what I do personally with my physical challenges, I just hope that I can inspire other people to take on their own Everest. And I don't mean that as in literally go and do an Everesting, but whatever their Everest is, whether it's running a 5K, whether it's losing a bunch of weight, whether it's, you know, giving up a bad habit or doing something twice as crazy as me, to say, do you know what? If he can do it, then so can I, because I'm just an ordinary guy. I've got two kids. I just decided I wanted to see how far I could push myself in life.
That's the core of what we want to accomplish with this podcast. It's not, for some people it'd be a quarter Everesting, and for some people it's their first 5K, right? It's whatever you think sounds currently impossible, whatever that is, right?
And yeah.
Calibrate it accordingly. Because there's people who've done double, triple, quadruple, and more Everestings, which to me is, you know, like, but that doesn't matter, right? It only, you need to go and do something that makes you weeks later reflect on it and just be in truly in awe of yourself, and you can do that, right?
Yeah, and I think the thing I really love about the Everesting community is we're all just everyday normal people. It's easy to look at professional sports people, and I look at what Lachlan Mawson's just achieved literally today with his FKT on the Tour Divide, and take
note. That's what I woke up to this morning.
I was the same. Wow. But before I went anywhere this morning, I looked and he had 6 kilometers to go, and I was like, right, pause everything because I need to just wait for this to all now happen and finish. But not to sort of downgrade what he's done, but I think sometimes, and maybe he's not the best example of this because he's such a grounded and humble guy, but I think sometimes when we look at professional sports people achieving these incredible accomplishments, it's very easy to look at them and say, I can't do that because I'm not like that person. I'm not a professional athlete. I haven't had this in life. But when you look at the Everesting community and the ultra community and the sort of that world, it's everyday people doing incredible things. They're people just like us, and there's someone out there who we can all relate to and say, do you know what? That's me. I'm that 40-year-old dad with two kids. And if he can do it, I know I can do it. And I think that's the really inspiring thing about the community and the podcast and all the stories that come out of this world.
Yeah, I agree. I think 99.9% of the people in the Hall of Fame are regular people. They've got jobs, kids, responsibilities, and they've got their own goals and beliefs in themselves, which is what sets them apart and what gets them there in the first place, right?
Yeah, and that's the thing, you know, they're fitting in the training around everything else.
With all the same challenges, right? Like family and work concerns and work travel and all of these things. So yeah, I just break down the excuses and one by one and go get after it. So thanks for doing this, Marcus. I really appreciate it. It's great to catch up with you. And when I'm going to keep an eye on you, and once you're planning that fifth one or that that fourth badge, I'm going to hit you back up and get you back on the podcast.
No, I'd love to. And I've got a few plans in the pipeline. It won't be for at least 12 months, but the more I've ridden off-road and the more I've done gravel climbs and things, the more I've sort of veered towards mountain biking. And there's a couple of long distance routes in America that I've definitely got my eye on that I'd love to come.
Does that include the Tour Divide?
It does, but definitely not trying to do any sort of FKT or anything or do it competitively. I'd love to come and do it from a point of view of maybe taking, you know, 3 to 4 weeks where still every day you're pushing big distances, but you're still enjoying the scenery and taking time to stop and take it all in and see the amazing sort of landscapes that are along the way.
Well, the Tour Divide starts about 100 kilometers from my front door. So if you're coming to Western Canada, let me know and we'll get a couple warm-up rides before we send you off.
Fantastic. No, that would be brilliant. We'll definitely stay in touch and I'll keep you updated on that front.
Yeah, please do. I hope we get to ride bikes together in person sometime.
Me too.
Thanks again for doing this. I really appreciate it. Be well.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks, Pete. Take care.
Thanks, Marcus. Take care.